I want to talk today something that I'm a little passionate about, that I think about a lot. I titled this, Are We Failing to Teach? As I'm putting this together this morning, I'm trying to do this balance between what I really want to say and what I should say. Okay? Because what I really want to say is probably not what I should say. But so somewhere in there is something that should be said to at least, and I don't want to provoke anybody to anger, but I do want to provoke everybody to study. Okay? It's just because I think this doesn't mean it's right. And if you study it and you find out I'm wrong, and no, I'm not bringing up anything controversial, but I'm bringing something up that affects all of us. And the more I see it going on, the more my heart goes out and hurts for others. Let me start up by asking this. Does it really matter how, this is a loaded question, does it really matter how or when we worship God?
Yeah.
Okay. So as long as I answer questions like that, and everybody agrees, then by the end of this, everybody should be in full agreement, right? So you all start out with somebody that everybody can, you know, jump on board and say, yeah, I'm all for that. Let me put it like this. Can we do it like little Frank Sinatra's and do it our way? Or should we look? I mean, he gives us all kinds of freedom. Don't get me wrong. But should we look and see if there's something that God says that he desires when it comes to worship? And try and incorporate that in what we do. In other words, can we do it our way, or should we do it as close to as God says that we should worship him? Should we do that? Probably everybody would agree with, yes. If God says this is how I want you to do something, we should get as close to that as we can. Here's the problem, and here's where everybody might not agree. What if we're busy? Or what if we just don't feel like it? What if our schedules and the things we have planned or whatever is so overwhelming? And I can relate to that. You know, somebody sent me a text says, I read that you've been up till 2 o'clock every night. Well, yesterday I got this text in the morning. It says, you don't have to call me right now. Or you don't have to call me. That was by my choice. Now, I did get to bed earlier. It was a little after 1 o'clock. I know Jeff and Herb were up later than me, because when I went upstairs, they were still up there and the lights were on and they were talking. But that was a choice. And yeah, I'm really going to have to get some sleep when I get home, but I don't want to miss it. I've got less sleep now than normal, a normal, you know, week. But I don't want to miss it. And maybe that's one of the things that got me thinking, because like I was talking to Frank and I told him, I said, you know, time is really one of the most precious things I have. And I'm spread with a lot of different responsibilities and areas. But what bothers me the most is when I see my own wife suffering because I don't have the time that she needs and deserves. Because I'm doing so many other things in so many different ways. And then people get upset because they've asked for this or they want this, and I just can't get to it. And I'm not saying this so nobody ever asks. I mean, if you have a need, let me know. But I feel sometimes like a juggler where I got all these balls in the air, and what can I do? And yeah, God comes first. One time, you know, so it's hard for her to argue against that. And she doesn't try. She understands. But, you know, she comes first before work and before so many. Yeah, she's looking at me like, oh, really? See, I'm digging. Mike, I'm doing what you're doing. I'm digging my own ditch today. Mike gets up, and that's why he won't talk, because every time he gets up, he says he digs his own grave. But what if we just don't feel like changing our schedules? What if there's something fun that we can do instead of doing something that God says? I mean, it would be great. It would be much. But God says to do this, and so you. But I really want to do this over here, and I. Or something that you think is real important, like your children. Hey, everybody's going to agree, your children are more important than yourself, okay? So the children want to do this, but it conflicts with what God says to do. So now you're really torn, and it should be an easy choice, you know, who comes first. But if you got to get up and you got to make that choice, now you're the bad guy or the bad girl. Woman, or the children are really upset. And then society tells us that we should put the children first, which is a true statement, but we teach our children what they're supposed to do by our own actions.
Yeah.
And you can set the correct example for your children, or you can set the incorrect example for your children. And all I'm going to say on this is, if you set the incorrect example for your children, what do you think they're going to do when they get older?
Yeah, that.
I've had so many people tell me, said, you know, my parents were hard on me, and they made me do these things, and I want to give my children more freedom and let them choose for themselves. And over the decades that I've been told this, what I see is the people saying that are in the church and worshiping God, and then when their children, but they want to be more lax for their children, and then when their children grow up, their children aren't in the church. They are, and their kids aren't. And then their hearts are tore up over it. I've seen this over and over and over, over the, you know, the last 4 decades. I've been minister. And then I think back about the kids that I knew growing up, you know, and how many of them, you know, most of them I don't even know where they are or if they're alive, or, but the ones that I do know, in our own family, my family, Mary's family, there's 7 kids in my family. Every single one of them had the same opportunity through my grandparents that I had. They'd bring them to church on the Sabbath. They brought them to their camp meetings. They brought them to the church functions. And same as me, every single one of my siblings is a heathen and has nothing to do with God. So I'm not saying that if you follow this formula, it's guaranteed right. But the odds of your own children, who are the more important than yourself, thing that bothered me, like with Mary's family, some of her sisters, with their kids, they wanted to be their children's best friend. Now, I'm talking about you got to be the disciplinarian and the, you know, the show them the rod of iron and all that stuff. But I'd beg them. We'd be over at their house. We lived in Wisconsin, and their kids are, and I'd say, let me whip them for you. Because they wouldn't. So I said, let me do it. Now, I'm not for whipping children. But sometimes the possibility that if you don't stop, that's in the realm of things that might happen, that can be a deterrent. But you want to be your child's friend, where they enjoy spending time with you, your grandchildren's friend, where they enjoy spending time with you. But you also have to be a parent or a grandparent. My grandparents would never compromise, not one inch, when it came to God, but I couldn't wait to spend time with them. What was the difference? Because the love that they showed me and their whole world just changed whenever I was there. And, you know, anything they had scheduled went out the window except for when it came to God. Then my schedule conformed to theirs because they were following God. And this is hard. Things like sports and, you know, plays and dance recite every, you know. My own grandchildren have not come on for because they were involved in some of that stuff. Or company. You know, when my parents first started coming to Tennessee, didn't see them very often. But if they were there on the Sabbath, guess what? If they wanted to see their son, guess where they had to go? You know, they came all the way down from Wisconsin to Tennessee to see their son. So, you know, getting in the car and driving 15 minutes wasn't that. And that was a full day thing. They didn't have to. It was like, here's the key to the house. We'll be back tonight, you know, whatever. That was my choice I made. And I'm not saying everybody, you know, just because I did it makes it right. But I'm trying to get everybody, because every person is different. I understand that. But find out that balance in your life for what God says you're supposed to do and obey Him. And yeah, even at my grandparents' house, there was times I didn't feel like going to church. It was boring. I mean, that sucked. Okay, all right, the kids' classes and the little felt board stuff, and yeah, I enjoyed that and singing. But after that was over, we had to go upstairs in the sanctuary and sit down. And, you know, as a kid, I thought, I got to sit down, I got to shut up, I got to be quiet. And I got to sit up there for an hour while this boring guy gets up there and talks about stuff I could care less about. And in Seventh-day Adventist Church, services are over at 12 o'clock. And I'm not making this up. I can remember jabbing my grandma and pointing to the clock that's on the wall. It's 12, like it's 12:05. He's 5 minutes into, he should have shut up 5 minutes ago. Now, I couldn't say this, but she knew what I was, you know, I'm looking at the clock and pointing. And she, shh, quiet. You know, here's your coloring book, or, you know. But I was mad because this guy's up there yapping, and he's stealing 5 minutes of my time. We're supposed to be telling everybody goodbye and getting out of there. Because it was boring and it sucked. I wasn't there to hear what he had to say. So I understand how kids, you know, I was one of them. But can we violate God's laws for the greater good? What about, you know, I tell people, say, well, you can't do one sin so you don't do another. You can't commit a sin because if I, you know, to avoid another sin. What's the goal? You don't sin at all. You don't do either one. You can't sin to do something that God says. Or you can't not do something He says so that you can do something that is okay to do. No matter how you work it, no matter how you structure it, if there's something that violates what God says to do or not do, that's the standard. And the thing that gets me is, a lot of kids don't even know the standard. A lot of it, and it's not the children. I should say this. It's not the children's fault. It is not their fault. Everybody wants to blame the kids. We had a problem years back in the church. And there was some people that were really mad at the kids. But it wasn't because of various things going on. But it was not those kids' fault. The fault landed 100%, well, I was going to say 100% on the parents, Because kids want to do what their parents teach them, and every kid wants to make his mom or dad happy. You know, they want to please them because they want to get that, you're such a good little boy, you're such a good little girl. They desire that. But a lot of the blame laid on me. The parents didn't even know, so that was my fault, I guess. But the people, the adults themselves, you got these some adults mad at the children. And if you want to make somebody mad, just, you know, get mad at their kids. And guess what kind of relationship you're going to have with those kids' parents? It's not going to be pretty. But I ask the question, can we violate God's laws for the greater good? How was the Ark of the Covenant supposed to be moved? Let's take a look at Numbers chapter 7, verse 4. It says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, accept these from them, that they may be used in doing the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and you shall give them to the Levites, to every man according to his service. So everybody, most people know, okay, the Levites are supposed to move the Ark of the Covenant, well, the tabernacle and everything that is involved with it. And yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about Uzzah, but I've heard people say, well, Uzzah touched the Ark and he wasn't supposed to. If you look at who Uzzah's brother was, he was a Levite. If your brother is a Levite, what does that make you?
A Levite.
A Levite. So there's more to this story than that, okay? But keep it going. Verse 6, it says, so Moses took the carts and the oxen and he gave them to the Levites. Two carts and four oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon according to their service. And four carts and eight oxen he gave them to the sons of Merari. So oxen are involved in moving it. Yes, they weren't doing it correctly, and it's, you know, David allowed it and all this stuff, but it's not that far away. There's some things they did wrong, but it's not that far away. You know, first time I read this and thought about it, I said, well, first, you know, there's oxen involved here. The cart, you know, stumbled or whatever and hit a rock or whatever it did. But it says, according to their service and under the authority of Itamar, the son of Aaron, the priest, but to the sons of Kohath he gave none, because theirs was the service of the holy things which they carried on their shoulders. Well, that's one of the clues. How about the Ark of the Covenant? Would that have been... Everything that dealt with the tabernacle was holy because it was dedicated, it was set aside, it was Kodesh, it was for God. But what about the Ark of the Covenant? Out of all of the things that they had to pack up and move, where did that stand in the level of holiness? The most holy of everything, okay? That had the mercy seat where Jehovah hovered above. It was his throne in the tabernacle on the earth. Now we all know where they put that because the story's in the Bible. But not only were you supposed to be a Levite, you had to be a subdivision of the Levites under the division of Kohath. Like, not every Levite was, to explain it like this, not every Levite was a direct descendant of Aaron and his sons. Aaron and Moses were brothers, so Moses was a Levite, but his children were not descendants of Aaron. And the priests that serve in the temple were supposed to be Aaron's sons, but all of the Levites had special responsibilities and positions. None of them could own any land. They were all, you know, but to go on and get a real deep in that, I just wanted everybody to have like the 500-foot view. So, Numbers chapter 4, verse 15 tells us that the ark was, well, first, they were supposed to cover the ark, because there's other places that it talks, and I think everybody understands and knows this. You know, one, the ark was in the Holy of Holies, and the only one that saw it in the Holy of Holies was the high priest one day a year on the Day of Atonement and that. So when you take it out and you're going to move it, there's rings and there's poles, and so you just don't throw it on an oxen cart, but you're supposed to cover it. And why would you cover it? Because so you don't see it, so you don't look at it. But in Numbers 4:15 it says, "And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is set to go, then the sons of Kohath shall come in to carry it." So see, you cover these things. And then Kohath's sons and his descendants after that come in to carry the holy things on their backs to move them. But see, it says, "The sons of Kohath shall come to carry them, but they shall not touch any holy thing lest they die." So he's very specific. Cover it, carry it, but don't touch it. Now, how can you carry something without touching it? Well, that's what the rings and the poles and everything else are for. "These are the things in the tabernacle of meeting which the sons of Kohath are to carry." So I think everybody gets the gist of how it's supposed to be done. See, God's very specific, in other words. He's much more specific even than, you know, when we're going to worship Him in a building or a fellowship or a church or something. He doesn't tell us what time. He tells us what day, but He doesn't tell us what time we have to meet. He doesn't tell us things like, okay, first you're going to have a prayer, and next you're going to sing two hymns, and you're going to sing the first, the second, and the fourth verse of each hymn. And then, you know, I mean, we have freedom to work these things out, and as long as it's all geared to Him, we have a lot of freedom in what to do. You know, are we going to sing messianic songs? Are we going to sing, you know, 18th century hymns? Or, you know, are we going to do a mixture? Or how are we going to do it? Or how many of them are we going to sing? There's so much freedom that we have. But He is very, when He's specific about something, my point is, He's serious. And it's not just how to hold the service and what the order to do it and what songs to sing. Anything in our lives, when He specifies something, He's serious. Now, thank goodness it says, "lest you die," because I'd be dead many, many, many times over. And probably a lot of other people would too. But what about when something comes up that's really, really important? And it causes us, or in our minds anyhow, we think somehow it's okay to go against something that He's been real specific about. Now let's go back to 2 Samuel 6:6 and read this. It says, "And when they came to Nashon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God." And you have people that look at that and said, "He was doing a good thing. Why did God smite him dead? He was doing a good thing." You know what? God would have, when He says you have to do it like this, even if we don't understand and we can't comprehend. And people say, "Well, if He wouldn't have done that, it would have fell off the cart and it would have hit the ground and it would have been smashed, damaged, defiled, ruined, whatever. So He did a good thing by stopping that from happening." Well, maybe. Maybe that would have happened. Or maybe somehow God would have performed a miracle and it would have just hovered there for a while and gone back on the cart. We'll never know. But by this example, it tells me that when God tells us to do something and we know that's the right thing to do, even if we think it's going to cause something else down the line bad that could happen, so we're going to rescue ourselves or somebody else from this bad thing that could happen, we better trust God. And if something bad happens, In this instance, the only reason that something bad could have happened in the first place is they were screwing up and not doing it the way God said to do it. For whatever reason, they chose not to follow His instructions. And that put them in a situation where something bad can happen. Now, I don't think I got to explain how every time on anything that we choose in our lives not to follow God's instructions, we are putting ourselves and our children and other people around us in a situation where something bad could happen. It's the same thing as somebody, and I'm not just picking only on the smokers. I understand that that's a very difficult thing to get rid of, but it's sort of like somebody that smokes and they get lung cancer, and they're in the hospital in ICU, and they got all kinds of tubes coming out of them, and they're laying in bed, and they're crying out, "Why me, God?" As if somehow it's His fault, because He didn't. They prayed. They prayed, "Heal me, God." And yes, He could heal them instantly, and then what would happen? They'd just keep on smoking, and they'd guess what's coming back. You know, do they really expect that the first time they went to reach into their pocket for their pack of cigarettes to pull them out, what was God supposed to do? Paralyze their arm? You know, literally they'd be doing this, trying to dig it out because their arm didn't work, or putting it up here and trying to grab it with their teeth so they can pull them out. And then you take your lighter out and you light it so you can light the cigarette or the pipe or whatever it is that you got. And every time you try and light it, he blows up and the thing goes out. You know what? I bet you they'd be saying some things using God's name that were, especially if the cravings were super, super tough, that might not be so complimentary about God. He allows us to make these choices, is my point. And it's not just with cigarettes, it's not just with food and nutrition, it's with everything that we do. Every day we make hundreds and hundreds of decisions. And He allows us to make those decisions. How to treat our children. How to raise our children. How to treat our spouses. How to treat our parents. How to treat our brothers and sisters that we fellowship with. How to treat your neighbor. We have the freedom. If every time you're going to do something bad, if he gives you, you know, if he just smites you and your feet go out from under you and you hit the ground and you can't even talk, you kind of like drool, you know, help. Sometimes I admit I'd like to see that happen when somebody's going to do something to hurt somebody. I'd like to see them just kind of hit the ground and flop around for a little bit. Maybe got to get their attention. Maybe I shouldn't do that. But see, He doesn't want a bunch of programmed, mindless idiots. You want your children to love you, not because they're afraid of you, but because they know that you love them and you do so much for them. When you come home, you want them, and if they aren't with you, you want them to come running across the room, "Mommy, Daddy, what?" Jump in your arms and, "Oh, we miss you." And now most of us, if that happens, we think, okay, what happened? What'd you do? But you don't want to have to think like that. You want them to know that it's pure and innocent and they are so happy to be with you and their world just lit up because you walked in the door. That's what you want. But see, to get that, we have to do the things that we're supposed to do as a parent for our children to give us that reaction. All right, let's go on. I've said enough about that. Let's take a look at what about if we're too busy to prepare for the Sabbath, to get ready, to even get enough sleep? You're tired. or mentally everything has just come crash down on you and you can't even function. Your stress level is beyond belief, and you just don't feel like you say, "Hey, it's the Sabbath. I'm supposed to rest. I think I'm going to bed for the next 24 hours. I'll see you tomorrow." Or what if you didn't get something done that you wanted to get done, and now here it's the Sabbath, and it can be anything from cleaning the house to, you know, preparing something to worship God, to bring to church, to worship God with, a lesson for the kids, or, you know, you just haven't had time to even do any of that. Well, working on something for the kids, I guess that's perfectly fine. You're supposed to be doing that. But something, you're going to bring something for a meal to contribute, and you don't even have anything. You look in the cabinet, in the refrigerator, in the freezer, and there's nothing. Quick, honey, run out to the store and go get this because we're going to need something to bring to the, for, you know, I promised so-and-so we were going to bring this Sabbath, and I didn't do it. So they're counting on us. My ox is in the ditch. Maybe people shouldn't think, and yes, there are things like your ox is in the ditch, but that doesn't really bring it to that level. Maybe the next time you think, is this really, you got to ask, and then you got to ask God, is this truly an ox in the ditch, or this is the cart that's about to stumble, and for the greater good, I'm going to violate what you said to do so something doesn't happen. You know, even if it comes down to something, food or whatever, if people can go 24 hours for the Day of Atonement, we can kind of do it light for potluck. It's not going to kill nobody. Maybe they'll mumble and grumble like the children of Israel, but who are they? They're the children of Israel. So what's the big deal? You apologize. Exodus 35, verse 2. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh day shall be a holy day for you, a Sabbath of rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. Kind of simple. Kind of straightforward. You would think it'd really be hard to mess that up. Very specific. I'm glad God doesn't smite us dead like Uzzah, because... Yeah, like Israel says, there wouldn't be nobody left. But it should rise to that level in our minds. Is this the right thing to do or not? It's only this once. My boss said, I have to. There's an emergency. It's only this once. I'll pray for forgiveness afterwards. I think enough. There's an East Tennessee state. Enough said. All right. Let's look at Leviticus chapter 10, verse 1. Then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it, put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. These guys were in the right place at the right time, doing the correct functions for their priesthood duties, but they chose to take fire from an unauthorized source. Doesn't say where they got it, but it wasn't. See, the fire for the incense was supposed to come off of the altar that the offerings were made on. So from this, we know, obviously, they didn't do it They did it their own way, but they were trying to worship God. Let's give them the... They were trying to do what they were supposed to do. They just didn't do it the way God says to do it. And they're dead. And then Aaron was told, don't even mourn for them. You know, basically, get to work, don't mourn for them. And people look at this and they say, oh, that's such a cruel and harsh God. That he would do something like that. And yeah, years ago I started reading commentaries, and some of the commentaries are out there. Well, you know, it talks about alcohol right here, so it's probable that they made this mistake because they had been drinking alcohol, and you know, they just weren't. Maybe that's true, but that's, even if it's no excuse. I don't know why he talks about alcohol in the surrounding verse there, but whatever. It doesn't tell us why or where they got the fire from. It just tells us they didn't follow his instructions. He was specific on this, and they're dead on the spot. Now, he doesn't smite us dead today like then, when we violate specific things. But spiritually and salvationally is just another bullet in our heart. What would happen, Leviticus 16:29, what would happen if the high priest were to go into the Holy of Holies on the wrong day? I mean, think about this. You're the high priest, and there's one day a year that you can come in there. And yeah, there's the incense and the smoke and everything. So it's not like Moses where you're talking face to face, pelepe, literally nose to nose. And you see them clearly. But this is the high point of your year. This is, and you're the one that God chose to come in personally before him. So even if you're doing it in the wrong day, there's this desire, you want to get in there. You want to worship him. But in Leviticus 16:29, it says, this shall be a statute forever for you. In the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, you shall afflict your souls. And do no work at all, whether a native of your own country or a stranger who dwells among you. For on that day the priest shall make atonement for you to cleanse you, that you may be clean from all your sins before the Lord. It is a Sabbath of solemn rest for you, and you shall afflict your souls, and shall be a statute forever. So it's very specific on what day you're supposed to do this. Now I got all excited. I don't know how long ago it was, 10 years or so maybe, when the Sanhedrin, they formed a Sanhedrin again. The Sanhedrin is like the 70 elders type of thing. Because maybe 20 years ago, and Mary was there, I was at a conference, and there was a rabbi there. His name was Chaim Richman. And he was the director of the Temple Institute. Anybody knows what the temple is? They're trying to build the third temple and all that. And we had mutual friends, and afterwards, after his talk was over and everybody went up and asked him questions and whatnot, you know, I waited. And I asked him, I says, Kyle, let me ask you a question. I said, you live in Jerusalem itself, yeah. And I talked to him before and but anyhow, I said, so you're in the land. I said, let me ask you a question, what you're going to do here, or how you do this. I said, you're going down to the shul, the synagogue, and you're going to, and it's, I forget the word now. I'm tired. But anyhow, it's the new moon. Because every new moon, Jews will go to... Huh? Yeah. Every new moon, they will go down to the synagogue, and the man, at least the men will, they have to have their rules, their minion, 10 men, and they come down there and they pray. I said, so you're walking from your house, and you're walking down to the shul, the synagogue, and I says, do you not look up? Because if you looked up, you'd see there's no new moon. I said, you know anciently how this was done. I said, you're the director of the Temple Institute, and you're trying to put everything together for the rebuilding of the third temple. I said, what if you're successful, which I think you will be, but so you're successful, and what if you are the high priest? It's Yom Kippur. And the calendar that you're following says it's the 10th day of the 7th month, but you know that it was only 8 nights ago that the crescent was out there. The new moon was out there. I says, or what if this takes a while and it's your son? I'm not making it. Mary was there. He's a smaller, short, you know, he's like 5'2" or something. Very quiet type of guy. And he reaches up and he pats me on the back. He says, Mark, you worry too much. He says, let me tell you something. When the Sanhedrin is reestablished, their first official act will be the restoration of the sighting of the moons in the calendar. We won't have to worry about that. That was maybe like 20 years ago. So 10 years ago or whatever it was when the Sanhedrin was reestablished, I'm thinking, I read about it, and I think, wow, okay. What are all these churches going to do now? The Jews have the oracles of God, and they set the calendar, and that's why we do what we do. Except when it comes to Pentecost, we just ignore it on that because we don't do Sivan 6. We know when the correct day is for that, so we're going to ignore their calendar, most of them then. And then I find out Chaim Richman is on the Sanhedrin. I say, wow, this is going to be great. And guess what's happened? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Except that you can go to Sanhedrin.org, and they're actually, every month, they're going through the procedures, and they're taking testimony from witnesses, and they're declaring the months and all of this. And I sent it, I know I sent it to Mike and Brenda, so go back through your emails and stuff and find that article for me if you can. And I got to search for it, because like 3 years ago when there was a month different, like it is this year, on the and to me, the Sanhedrin doesn't carry any weight. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. If they come out with a ruling, that doesn't mean we follow it, because a lot of the things that they're going to rule on are not, it's tradition and not biblical. But like 3 years ago, when there was a month difference, they actually put an article up on their website that anciently, according to the biblical calendar, and that, you know, Jewish calendar was 1 month early, that they wouldn't be observing Pesach or Passover this month. It would be a month later. And people say, how do you know? How do you hear such a thing? And Herb spends thousands of hours digging out references and stuff. It is not a secret. Mary and I, when we were studying the calendar and that 25 years, whatever, however long ago it was, we went down to the synagogue. He said, go ask the rabbi, right? That's what everybody says. Boy, those rabbis, they must be experts on, you know, hey, let's go down and ask the rabbi how you pronounce God's name. He'll know. Which, by the way, I don't want to make this too long, but everybody knows the little story about how the guy actually did this. He went to a rabbi and he says, rabbi, how do you pronounce God's name? He says, whoa, it's very simple. You know, this is a story, a fib, because they would never tell you this. If they told you anything, guess what? It's going to be wrong. But he says, is it Yahweh or how do you pronounce, or, you know, there's, we don't know. There's so many people saying it, so many. He says, are you? He says, well, that's really simple. He says, Yahweh. He says, oh, Rabbi, thank you so much, so much. Oh, this is wonderful. I'm going to go tell all my friends. He says, you're welcome. So back to this. I'm going to sprinkle a little bit of humor in there. What about if we know it's the right thing to do, but some people might not agree? Might not be happy. You better keep your mouth shut because they don't want to hear it. You might get kicked out if they find out you're doing this. So you better do it in secret. Sometimes things that God tells us to do are difficult. It can even, believe it or not, offend somebody else. No matter how hard you try not to be offensive, if you do everything God says to do, somebody is going to be offended. Or difficult. You can't be serious. You know, when people say, anybody that knows me, you know, and I know people get tired of me harping on it. Matthew 5:17. How many of God's laws are still valid out there? Which ones have been canceled? None?
Mark?
Yes.
Is it?
I'll look afterwards. If it's it, I'm going to put it up on the screen and post it on the feast list. And because here we are in another year just like then. But I remember sending it to you specifically, and I don't know who else. But anyway. Oh, I was starting to tell us, Mary and I go down to the synagogue, and I tell them I'm there. I want to study about Calvin. And this, there was no such thing as the Messianic Synagogue in Knoxville at this time. And he says, what do you care? You know, he knew we kept the Sabbath. And I was minister, head of church. We kept the Sabbath, which he thought was like kind of a strange duck. But he knew about Seventh-day Adventists and stuff. Now we're not Seventh-day Adventists. We just do what God says to do. And then I tell him, well, I'm really interested in the calendar from the aspect of the holy days. And what do you care? You're Gentiles. He says, well, we observe the holy days, and if we're going to do them, we want to do them at the right time. And I'm trying to be very polite and say, and I didn't say, well, I know you're doing it at the wrong time. I just want to do it at the right time. I didn't say that, because you're not going to get very far if you know. But I said, there's some disagreements about how it's supposed to be done and when it's supposed to be done. And he said, well, okay. So he got up and he walked over. We were in his office and he walked over to his shelf and he pulled out a little book. It was like a children's primer. And they teach Jewish kids this on Sundays when they have their Hebrew classes and that. And he gave us a book about the calendar. And it included why they're doing the things that they're doing and the, you know, Hallel and, you know, some very simplistic stuff in there. But he just gave it to us. My point, I didn't even bring this up, is we left and we said, it's a secret to everybody out there in the churches that there's even something going on that's not right. It ain't no secret to them. It's just a secret to all of the Christians trying to keep the holy days. Now, it didn't have all the technical deals in it, but it was just simple enough to tell the kids that, you know, it's not exactly how, and they didn't even say how and why, but it doesn't work today like it used to then. But back to this. What if what God tells us to do is actually difficult for somebody else or offensive or whatever the thing is? 1 Samuel 15:10, it says, now the word of the Lord came to Samuel saying, I greatly regret that I have set up Saul as king. Now this came up a few nights ago you know, well, why didn't David just kill Saul? But anyhow, I greatly regret that I have set up Saul as king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. So why was God displeased with Saul? Because Saul didn't do what God said to do. So then it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night. And it tore Samuel up that their king, their leader, had displeased God. You know, if we have really done our job and our kids are old enough to comprehend some of this, when they see us not doing, if we've taught them this is what we're supposed to do, and they see us not doing it, it will grieve our children, because their king and their queen have displeased God. That's what our children should know. If they truly are the most important thing we have, we need to somehow equip them to have a relationship with God and to know these things. I'm going to do this really quick. Most people understand that Satan has a mark. In Revelation 13:6, it says, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. And people are going on, and they're trying to figure out what is this? Is this, you know, the title on the Pope's crown, Fili Dii, whatever it is, numerical value of 666? Is this a tattoo? Is this a chip? Is this a vaccine? And there's all kinds of theories out there. But the bottom line is there is something out there, the mark of the beast. Okay? But a lot of people don't understand that God has a mark also. And really it's going to be a question, are you going to have this mark of the beast, or are you going to have God's mark? And I know the first time I was reading something on this, and I thought, God has a mark. You know, the only training religion I had, when I knew about the mark of the beast, Seventh-day Adventists, they have books written, that's Sunday, that's the mark of the beast. They got all kinds of material on that, but God's got a mark? Well, let me read this a little bit. Deuteronomy 6:6, it says, and these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and walk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as spotless between your eyes. Now Satan's mark is the mark of the beast, and it's where? On your hand or on your forehead. And this says, this shall be a sign, and you shall bind them on your... You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as spotless between your eyes. Maybe it's not just tefillin. The little boxes that Jewish people put on their foreheads and on their arms when they pray. I think it might be something more than that. It might symbolize something, but it's more than that. Revelation 7:3, it says, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of God on their foreheads. So here's the angels. They're ready to go out, and they're supposed to start at the temple of God and work their way out. And anybody that doesn't have that seal, slay them. Do you think it's important that you're sealed? Exodus 31:13, I've got it up there. It says, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths, plural, you shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord your God who sanctifies you. Everybody knows what a sign is. I put the Strong's up there, but, you know. If you're not doing what he says to do, when he says to do, you're not going to get this. And yeah, I really want to know. I know whatever the mark of the beast is, if you have it, if you don't have it, you can't go down to Walmart and buy your groceries. Somehow, the highly educated, specially trained checkout person at Walmart will know you do not have permission to buy this food. Whatever it is, they're going to know. You can't, sorry, can't sell it to you? Nope. Call security. We got one over here. Call security. So I don't want that, but I do want this seal. And I came to the conclusion a long time ago that people that are doing what God says to do, they're going to get that seal. Now we can get into the technicalities of it, and we can say what literally is it, and it doesn't say that the checkout clerk at Walmart can say, oh, this one has the seal of God, go and arrest them. I don't know that that's something that just anybody's going to be able to identify, but when the death angel starts coming out and spreading and just wiping people out with plagues and everything else, and they're falling over dead, they won't harm you. God demands something from his people. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 26, it says, "And you shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine." You know, sometimes you say things that are offensive to somebody else, and you'll get this phrase like, "Who do you think you are?" Now, I'm not saying you should just spout this out at the time when somebody's saying, "Who you think you're so righteous? You think you're better than anybody else? And you think just, you know, not keeping Christmas or, you know, because you do this, that makes you so righteous?" But the correct answer, when they say, "Who do you think you are?" if you're doing what God says, is you're holy and you're separated from the peoples. If you're down there with everybody else doing, and I'm not saying you're not supposed to talk to people and help them and minister to them and help them overcome and everything, because Jesus was right there in the midst of them and he was criticized for doing it. But guess what? He never did. He never just joined in the fun and did what everybody else was doing. Peer pressure and family pressure and whatever it is, that's huge. And very few people can withstand that. Matthew 13:52 says, "And he said to them, therefore every teacher of the law who has been instructed about the kingdom of heaven is like the owner of a house who brings out of his storeroom new treasures as well as old." That's what we're supposed to be doing with everybody around us. Not just the same old stuff that everybody knows and everybody does and everybody accepts, because nobody is doing everything right. In fact, if we're honest with ourselves, we're doing more wrong than we are right. But you got to take things one thing at a time. And it's not necessarily, it would be great if everybody could just take the biggest issue that there was and tackle that one. But sometimes it's so big and so overwhelming that it's impossible. We will fail guaranteed. So sometimes you got to attack it like, you know, Dave Ramsey and his debt courses. You know, you take the smallest debt that you have, whether it's the smallest balance on this high interest credit card, and you pay that off. Take the easiest sin you have that you can overcome. Pray and ask God for help. And start attacking that sin. And, you know, when you pay that credit card off, what do? You say, whoa. Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with doing that. Say, that was an accomplishment, because it was. But you don't stop. The reason he calls it a snowball is now you take that money that you used to make that payment on that credit card, you take that money and you put it on the next biggest debt. And you start paying them off one after one. And then finally you get to things like your house. Get rid of all of that. But if you tell people, well, you need to get out of debt, and most people, it's their house. The biggest debt you have is, why don't you just go pay your house off? And they're going to look at you like, are you crazy? This is going to take 29 more years. Why don't you just quit sinning? It's the same concept. If you have to take the easiest one, start there. And when you think you've got everything, start bringing out. And there's nothing really new when it comes to God and His instructions. It's new to us. But out of the storehouses, you know, there's another verse in the Bible that says, talks about the ancient past, P-A-T-H-S. Having a hard time saying it. That if we find those, we'll have rest. That path is new to you if you've never heard it, never thought. You're looking for it and you find it and you actually take that ancient path. It's good for us and we do find rest in our hearts and our souls. But it's nothing new. When somebody comes to you with new truth, watch out, look out. It's something that they've conjured up, and they're going to impart their special knowledge upon you. But some people in this room work on their own cars or repair things and fix things. If it breaks, they have skills, you know. Have you ever, if you work a lot with your hands, have you ever tried to fix something that was in a difficult to reach spot, or it required, Mike's laughing, it required something unique to be able to accomplish this, and you spend all day long trying with the wrong tool, trying to get to whatever it is you're trying to fix to get it to work right? Or, when you're going through your toolbox, and whether it's, you know, utilities or code or whatever you've written yourself, or it's a physical toolbox or a drawer in your house where you keep your stuff, and you're digging through there and you're looking for something, and then all of a sudden you find this tool and you pull it out and you say, what the heck is this for? You got it, but you don't even remember what the purpose of you getting this thing. You paid it, you made it, whatever, but you don't even remember what this thing is for. And you're looking through your box of wrenches, and you're looking for a specific wrench, and they're all the wrong size. So you're going to try and improvise. I believe that many of us have been taught to worship God with the wrong tool from the wrong toolbox. I really do think that. And that's become sacred and holy to us because it's tradition. Or other people saw somebody doing something that was tradition to them and they said, that looks like fun. It's not enough for our doctrines and the things that we believe to be true. I mean, that's good, but that's really not enough. If you're doing something by mistake that you're supposed to be doing, that's a good thing. But shouldn't we all know why we do what we do? Not only are our doctrines and beliefs true, We should have the tools to show others why they're true. To show our children, our parents, our grandparents, if they're alive, our brothers, sisters, neighbors, other people we fellowship and worship with. If you don't, it'll be like that tool, what the heck is this? If you stumble across it, you'll say, what is this for? I don't even know why I got this. How are you going to show your own children? Let's just start with your children. Something more important than yourself. I've said it many times today. If you don't give them the tool that they need to develop a relationship with God and have that personal thing. When I first talked, the first day I talked about people that have died and they want, they're on their deathbed, and the most important thing for them is to pass that relationship on that they have to their children and the other people that they love and care about. I told you the story about Stella calling her family in and getting them. Pulls her Bible out, and they're all washing each other's feet because she says, you know what it is tonight? It's Passover. I talked to, I think it was Jeff I was talking to, and conversation come up, and I figured it out this morning. 37 years ago, I took trigonometry and calculus and got an A in both courses, but I haven't used it since, and I can't do it. It's gone. Talking to, I think it was Ethan. When I was 16 and 17, I played the piano. My mother was a piano teacher. Guess what I can do on the piano today? I can tell you where middle C is. I remember that. Chopsticks. I can't even do chopsticks. I'm sorry. It's gone. I didn't use it. And it's gone. How am I going to teach my granddaughter to play piano when I can't do it myself? Yeah, pay for a teacher. But what if I want her to have these memories? You know, Grandpa taught me this. What will happen to our people today, our children today, our siblings and our friends and our family and the others that we love, if they see no relevance in our doctrine because we don't even know what our own tools are for? We don't even understand why we're doing the things we're doing, but we got a good feeling about this group or this place or this feast site or this. So we're just going to go there because we feel good and we know somehow deep down that they're doing something right, but we don't know how or why or whatever, just that we feeling good, that's a good start. Okay? That's fantastic. It's a whole lot better than going somewhere and feeling awful. Like, man, did we make a mistake? If we had the money, we would go over here and get new reservations and we'd get out of here, but we're stuck. You know, a lot better than that, but we better start figuring these things out and helping others understand. I've seen the standards in the church decline, and I only got two more quick verses, so I'll shut up pretty soon. But I've seen standards in the church decline. Now, I'm sounding like my grandpa. You know, I thought, oh, man. And I never wanted to sound like that, okay? It's like, oh, Grandpa, come on. I love you, but you're an old man and you just don't understand. Him telling me the stories about the Depression and people, you know, coming through and hungry and now they're just going to kill you and take whatever you have. And, you know, in the 70s, he's telling me all of these. And I was like, Grandpa, you don't. But I'm sounding like him and I'm not trying to. But I wish I would have listened. I wish I would have listened to Mary's parents. Her dad didn't, her dad, the company he worked for that he was supposed to retire from, provide for his family, they stole the pension, the employee's pension, and all of the employees got nothing. You work your whole life, and you're going to retire, and you find out there's nothing there. So you take a job. Nobody wants to hire you. He did sand castings for aluminum things, that the things you would make. I think she still got some of the, not for business, but he would make things that were really kind of neat, bells and different things. But he's an older man. I'm trying to think how old he was when I met her. He's in his 60s, 62, 3, something like that. He was born in 1911. We got married in 1976, so 75, okay. So anyhow, he's an old man. Wait a minute. Yeah, Frank's just saying, I didn't finish, Frank. You jumped in there too quick. I said, wait a minute, maybe he wasn't really that old, okay? He was 64, okay. Maybe he wasn't that old. I was a smart aleck punk kid, and it really bothered her mother more than me, than him, because I'm 16 years old, and I'm making more money at 16 years old, running a business, than her husband, who worked all of his life and then got, at the end of it, got everything was stolen from him. And here comes this punk kid that doesn't want nothing to do with God in the first place and thinks he's hot stuff. And, you know, nobody wanted to hire him. He's an old man doing very difficult manual labor. So he struggled. But we didn't listen to him. The knowledge, the experience. He had a relationship with God. Even when it came to his own family, God was coming first. Talk about things that God tells you to do that can be difficult. That's maybe not popular even in your own family with your wife and your children who you love, who you would do anything for. The love that he had for his own children. You know, I talked about disciplinarian, the rod of iron and all that stuff. You can ask Mary sometime, how many spankings did she ever get her entire life from her father?
None.
Zero. Not one. She didn't have to. She loved him so much, she wouldn't do something she wasn't supposed to because she would disappoint her father. That's the kind of love that we need to pass on to our children and others around us. But he was a foolish old man, and he didn't know people took advantage of him, and he'd just roll over and let people do things, and, you know. And that knowledge he had and her mother had is gone. Died with them. A few out of 9 children are still in a church, a Sabbath-keeping church, and keep the Sabbath. But the vast majority of them did not. And that are still alive do not. But some of them do. Those examples. Mary never knew why her father wouldn't keep Christmas until after he was dead. He knew what God said. It's not enough to know our doctrines. Are we truly doing what it says in Leviticus 20:26? Are we holy and separated from the people out in the world? And it doesn't mean, like I said, become a monk and just not have nothing to do. If you have this relationship, how's anybody else ever going to know unless they have interaction with you? So Jesus is their example. Do what he did. Even if it means hanging around with sinners and publicans, then just don't let those things suck you in. Compromise to conform. How can we convince somebody that the Sabbath is a gift if we can't convince our own children? What do our children think? What do our neighbors think? We did a really bad job when we bought our house. I don't remember when it was. Like 1990, somewhere around in there. Our neighbors asked our kids, where do you guys go on Saturday afternoons? They see us all getting in the car. I'll go every Saturday afternoon. And we're not home. And then they see me out there in the summertime mowing the grass on the Lord's Day. And, you know, so what are these heathens doing on Saturday afternoon? Because they always get together. Sometimes they even got a Bible in their hands when they're getting out to the car and that. Our neighbors, your neighbors shouldn't have to go to your children and say, what are your mom and dad doing on Saturday? Where are you guys going? We're not doing our job if they have to do that. For one thing, maybe they don't want to hear the answer. Oh, what are they? A bunch of heathens. What are they? They don't want to hear none of this. Well, they were at least curious enough to ask. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 5 says, surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them. For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? For whatever reason we may call upon him. And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments are in all this law which I set before you today? Where was their knowledge supposed to come from? God's law. I'm sorry, but you sit down with most people that keep the Sabbath and holy days, and you say, I want to talk about the statutes and the judgments and the ordinances. I want to talk about the precepts in the law. They say, let's just talk about the Ten Commandments. Without this, there is so much that is gone, that is not understood. How can you meditate on his law? How can that be your delight? And people say, well, we're in the new covenant. Okay. Frank's laughing. He knows. Let's look what the New Covenant says. Let's go to Deuteronomy 31:31. Let's go to Hebrews 6, 8, whatever it is. It says, and I was not right. I shouldn't have done this. But it says they're written in your mind and in your heart. That's right. Recite, please. That was the wrong thing to do. Don't do it like that. But... if we love God and we love his laws and we understand that they're for our own good, and we teach them, like it says in Deuteronomy 6, when we rise up in the morning, when we go to bed at night, we teach them diligently to our children, we can at least tell somebody some of them. Is this our prayer? Is this your prayer? Have you ever... hopefully you have. I'm asking a rhetorical question. Have you ever prayed something like this? Psalms 119, verse 10. With my whole heart I have sought you. Oh, let me not wander from your commandments. Do we do things with our whole heart? Or do we fit God into our crazy busy schedules and we let Satan put up a roadblock time after time after time, and we fail with the most important task we have? Our children and next those that we love, those that we care about. It's a high bar today. I understand that. This isn't a warm and fuzzy feel good. But it hurts that the standards keep going down and down and down. And people are conforming more and more with the world. And Satan is winning big time. And I understand sometimes it's frightening to stand up and say, get behind me. No, we're going to do what is right. And sometimes it's not popular. It's not popular with your own family, with friends, with people, other people you care about. And I don't know if I knew the correct way. I'm a failure at this. If I knew the correct way to say it, I would say, this is the magic formula. You say it like this. I can tell you 150 million different ways how not to say it. But if it's with our whole heart, maybe then people will come to us and say, I don't know what you got. I think you're crazy, but I want some of it. I'm going to end with this last 60 second. There was a company I worked for, I don't know, a long time, several years. And there was a woman come to my office one day, and she knocks on the door and she says, can I ask you something? I said, sure, what do you want? And she says, we just found out my daughter, she had a daughter who was a little over a year old. She said, we just found out my daughter has leukemia. She says, will you pray for her? And even then, I kind of blew it in a way. I said, you want me to pray for your daughter? And she said, yes. I says, why do you want me to pray for your daughter? You think I'm crazy. I said, absolutely, I will pray for your daughter. I says, but you don't agree, because we talked just a little bit, and you know, she's a good Southern Baptist, and I talked respectfully, you know, and wasn't, I said, you think I'm crazy? She says, yes, I do, but I think maybe God will hear your prayers, and this is my daughter. I don't care what you think. I hope maybe God will hear your prayers. So I did. So it doesn't matter if they think you're crazy and they disagree with almost everything you think about God. Does somebody look at you and say, you know, that nutcase? They might have something there when it really counts, when they really need it. I've had people come up, and it's not because I look so handsome and dashing, and you know, but Mary and I go places, and people come up, and they'll say, are you a minister? You know, we're standing in line in Missouri in an expo center and waiting to get in, and you know, they want to know about, if we know anything about the Sabbath, yeah. Talk to them a little bit. What about the holy days? Yeah. You know, we've been studying this on our own. We don't know anybody else that does this. So we end up spending the first part of the expo talking to this couple. God will use you. In spite of yourself, God will use you if it's not a danger for him to send somebody to you. You ever think of it like that? If you were God, you got to ask yourself this question. If you were God, would you send one of your children over here to this one over here? I got a lot of growing up to do when I grow up and, you know, and I become a big kid. But the lacking part I realize is me. So I guess what I'm saying is we all need to work on ourselves. Because until we work on ourselves, we're kind of ill-equipped to help others that we love. If you don't know where to start, that's a good place. You don't understand? That's okay. Nobody else understands everything. But ask God to show you. Ask God to give you the ability so that you can show your spouse, so that you can show your children, so that you can show others in your family. Start with those that you love the most. But you gotta love God first. Thank you.